And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends who have been playing D&D for a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D keeps us company on the long roads that we travel.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I have been gaming for many years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. In 2021, they kind of put me in charge of Gnome Stew. So yeah, gaming has been a thing with me for a very long time, and I've been talking about it for a decade now.
I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and the clouds gather in the sky, blocking out the sun like the firmament above Barovia. But I'm going to keep gaming until all is well. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about companion characters in D&D. And then we're going to have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
The Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Dungeon Master's Guide distinguished between henchmen and hirelings. Hirelings were paid a set rate to do a specific job, while henchmen were somewhat like apprentice adventurers who were given a lesser cut of all treasure found. Hirelings were paid a set rate to do a specific job, while henchmen were somewhat like apprentice adventurers who were given a lesser cut of all treasure found. One of the things your character was expected to spend gold on was recruiting henchmen or hirelings for dangerous situations to make it less likely that the player characters would die. An additional purpose listed for henchmen was to act as a bodyguard for the other player characters against the plans of the other player characters? Man, AD&D 1st Edition Dungeoneering sure sounds like a hostile workplace.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
Since the last time we talked, I've had one session of Cygnus de Gur, the Monkeys of War, where we mostly wrapped up with the drow outpost fortress thing. So we were mostly, like, doing cleanup. We fought the big battle in the courtyard and all that, killed this drow lady and her brother. Okay, we are exhausted. We are completely tapped. Like, I don't think any of us had any abilities left, any spell slots, nothing. And, like, a short rest would have helped my character, Selena, a warrior, and Malcolm, our warlock, but everyone else was just like, yeah, that ain't gonna get you much back for me. So we're trying to figure out, can we take a short rest? Can we take a long rest? We figured out there were some people left in the building. We were inside. There were a couple of prisoners. There were a couple of former soldiers who had been framed for trying to poison the priestess. And then we found some servants that were actually the ones that poisoned the priestess lady person. We kind of freed both of them, and we're going to have them go on their way because I try very hard to make sure we do not turn into murder hobos. It'll be very easy for this group to turn into murder hobos and just kill everything in front of us. And I'm like, I can't play that way. I just can't. I love a good combat, a good fight, but you got to give me a reason. It can't just be because that thing looks like it's evil.
Mm-hmm.
That thing has to show me that it's evil. And these people were, yeah, they're drows, and they're probably, is it drow or drows? Anyway, they're drow. They're probably going to be problematic at some point in the future, but they haven't done anything wrong. They're victims of her. Please go. But then we realized we couldn't let them go together because they were going to try and kill each other because the soldiers had been framed and the servants had framed them. And so we made them go in separate directions because we're like, if you try and kill each other, we are going to kill you. So stop it and go. Just go. And then we found a couple of higher level envoy soldiers hiding in a guest bedroom. And like, okay, we're talking to them. We actually find out more about what's going on in the area from them. And then we also realize they are raging dickbags. They are bad guys. They are going to cause hurt and pain in the world. Selena, my character, and Malcolm, the warlock, just kind of exchanged a look. And I'm like, yep, let's do it. And the fight started and we dealt with them. And they were actually pretty tough for just being two guys, considering how tapped we were. But we still dealt with them. We did discover that the conflict that was driving the drow to try and get resources from the surface and all this was a conflict with a cult of Baphomet, which was mostly minotaurs, which were trying to summon Baphomet, and we're all like, oh, okay, they're bad guys too. I guess we better go deal with them. So we ended kind of taking a long rest in the fortress when we had declared that it was okay to go, and then ended with us starting off into the tunnels to head towards the cult of Baphomet. Of course, going the way that gaming goes, it's going to be a month before we play again. Because it turns out that I and one of the other players are headed to Yukon on the Saturday we would play. And then the Saturday after that is the Saturday after Thanksgiving, at which point our GM is going to be in Kansas with family. Oh, okay, we're not playing there. Now, my other Saturday group, I wrapped up a Savage Worlds Supers campaign that I called Find the Knight. And it was basically the Bat Family with the serial numbers filed off. Very generic Gotham City, Batman's missing, his proteges and friends need to figure out what happened to him. I ran that for like 5-6 sessions or so, and then wrapped it up with them basically going into hell to defeat a demon lord and get the Night Guardian back. It was pretty good. It wasn't the best I've ever run, but it was pretty fun. But one of the other players, Les, has decided to step up and GM for the first time. What we are doing is a 5e game that's taking a little bit from Pugmire. We are playing anthropomorphic cats and dogs, not sexy tabaxis or werewolves or anything like that. We are playing cute little cats and dogs who are running around in a world where the humans have disappeared, and we are trying to solve the problems in this fantasy world where we're running around. I am playing a grave cleric based on my cat, Bella. She's a little weird, has no social skills whatsoever. but is very concerned for your well-being, which if you've ever met my cat Bella, you would know that this is very much what she is. We also have a wizard based on my one buddy's cat Kiko, which means that character is always hungry. We have a blind fighter monk based on my friend Chris's blind cat. It's funny, he has a tag on his character in Shard that says, blind, friend-shaped. We also have another cat character, which is not based on anybody's pet, but he is a very creepy, hairless cat warlock. And then we have two dogs. We have a pug bard and a chihuahua rogue.
So not large dogs.
No, not large dogs. We did meet a couple of larger dogs in the previous session. We played twice so far. It's a little lighthearted. The Poisoned Kingdom, which has been befouled, and occasionally bad stuff comes out of it, and we've realized the miasma of the Poisoned Kingdom is starting to encroach. So we had to fight some stuff near the town we were in, and then the mayor of that town asked us to go to the baron in the neighboring town to basically ask, what do we do? And then we were asked to basically go into the Poisoned Kingdom and find out what's going on. It's been fun so far. And honestly, I have been really enjoying helping Les with GMing advice and you know, different ideas and stuff like that. Because Les is one of my favorite people in the world to game with. But they haven't really run a lot of games. So they're running into some foibles. Like, it is very hard to start the session. People underestimate how hard it is to start a game.
I don't underestimate that. I know how hard it is.
And it's also one of those things, it's very hard to know, you know, pacing is something you only learn with practice. In learning where to leave space for the characters to interact with each other can be very hard. Our previous session was very short because we went through the content Les had put together super quickly because they weren't sure about how to have us explore a different area and was, you know, oh no, I need to get them to the fight and all of that. This is all stuff that this is why you start running, because then you learn how to do these things.
Yeah, it is very much a skill where you learn by doing.
we can sit here and talk about this till the cows come home, and we do, but you're still not going to cement some of it into your brain until you start doing it.
Hey, you know, speaking of cows coming home, if you ever get the chance to broker a peace between the drow and the minotaurs, the first thing you should say is, hey man, what's your beef? Our Thursday game is on hold until the new year, as we mentioned earlier.
Because scheduling.
Thankfully, I have actually had two other games in between, because my games that I run on a monthly basis have been aligning much better than my every other week game. So I did manage to run my Curse of Strahd game, which is my face-to-face game with my daughter and daughter-in-law and her friends. And we also played online our Tales of the Valiant Thrones and Bones game on Shard Tabletop. So I'm very happy that we got both of those in. In our Curse of Strahd game, we have our roster is starting to grow. We started off with three players and now we're up to five. Our newest player really wanted to play something necromancer-like. We had two problems with that. One is we already have a wizard in the party, although they're an evoker, so they blow things up and set things on fire. Not quite the same vibe. But the necromancer subclass is things like you are more efficient at casting animate dead and you get to use necromancy stuff cheaper or more effectively. It does feel very much like you are a scholarly wizard that studied to be a little bit better at doing what every wizard can do. So we wanted something that felt creepy and went a little bit beyond that. So she's playing a sorcerer. Second problem is there aren't that many sorcerer subclasses that are necromancer or undead oriented. And it's very strange to me that that is not the case. We did finally find one in the Grim Hollows Player's Guide. It is called the Haunted. And that subclass, one of the main abilities that it gets is when you summon a familiar, it is a specter.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It is neat. And the specter will go invisible until you want it to appear. And it can only use its life drain if you give up your actions for the round. So it is kind of balancing a little bit there. It does have a slight advantage over other familiars scouting because it can just like walk through walls. It was nice though, because this is her first ever game of D&D. She has played computer RPGs and she is friends with my daughter-in-law. So she wanted to play a tabletop game. Now she's getting the opportunity to do that. And she was actually really getting into that idea of having that specter like phase in and out of doors and seeing through its senses and telling people, you know, what she was seeing, because it made her feel like she was immediately contributing to the group, because she was scouting ahead and then our monk and our blood hunter would come along after and then go in the rooms and clear out whatever, you know, she had scouted ahead for them.
That's very cool.
Yeah, it's a neat dynamic right off the bat. Our cleric didn't get much spotlight time, but she can live with that because she got to use the holy symbol of Ravenkind to like burn a room full of vampire spawn with sunlight for a while that last session. So she can just bask in that for a while.
Literally.
Yes. The other thing was I had some focus issues when it came to prepping for that game. Not going to go too far into that, but it's just these last couple weeks have been kind of rough to focus and do things and motivate myself. So we had kind of a clunky start with that game because I hadn't prepped as much as I would like to, and I was fumbling to find where things were in my notes, because I've read through this whole section of Curse of Strahd, but when you're playing once a month, even if you've read through something, it's almost worse, because then you're thinking, I know this thing happens somewhere around here, I just don't remember like which room or at what time, but I know it's coming up.
I ran into it's like tangent. I ran into the same thing with my other Savage Supers game, which I ran last night because I knew we were starting with the characters in Atlanta looking for a young woman who could duplicate herself.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not for the life of me remember why they had figured out they needed to go to this particular shopping plaza in downtown Atlanta. I know this is where we're starting. I know this is the point, but I don't remember why, because it was a month ago and I did all my prep the night after we played.
Yeah. What was nice was once they decided that they needed to infiltrate the Burgermeister's house and find the person that he had locked up there, it got much more focused, because then it's like scouting around the house and interacting with NPCs that have to do with that quest. It was just getting started was rough, and I felt bad. I mean, because I was like fumbling for, what is this location? I don't even know what this is.
As I just said, starting is hard.
For our Thrones and Bones game, that is a less formal game where we're using the published adventures for that setting. We have 6 players. If we have a majority of players, we go ahead and play. A lot of times, like if we in our Thursday night game, we will have things that are important for someone to be there for. So even if we have most of our players, sometimes I don't want to run with fewer players. But in this case, it's just sort of like, if you show up and we have enough people, we're just going to go ahead and play. We had 4 out of 6 this time, so we went ahead and played.
I don't even think it's been majority, because the last time we played with 3 out of 6.
Yeah.
So I think it's as long as we have half or more.
Yeah, it's a little awkward for me to try and do a D&D session without at least 3 people, but I can make that work if I have 3 or more. The adventurers are supposed to be investigating this fortress that has not sent back any communications in a long time. Now that they have reached that fortress, most of this was exploring the fortress and, you know, finding out what was going on, learning, you know, all the secrets that are going on there. We had a Baldur's Gate 3 moment where our druid got to cast Speak with Animals. I had fun playing the snorty northern swine that they ran into. I do like that one of the plot points in this involves a romance, and it is not a standard heteronormative romance, but it is just a thing. It's not like scandalous. It is just, this is the thing that is the romance that is going on. And I kind of like that.
I was very amused because we get in there and we start picking up clues on what's going on. And we realize that the leader of this fort was in love with one of her underlings, and they apparently have turned on her and stolen a thing that has caused all of this havoc. And I'm like, I hate him. I hate him already. And then we're exploring around and we find one of the lady soldiers' diaries. And it turns out, no, it's not a guy. It's her. And she was in love. And oh, but she's also been seduced by. And I'm like, oh, man. I can't be quite as mad.
Eyes a hiccup. What's interesting about this adventure is there's really only been 2 or 3 combat encounters in these first couple chapters that you really can't avoid. It has really been a lot more of, yeah, if you want to be a jerk, you can go in fighting things. But for most cases, you're going to be able to talk things out. Our group mainly avoided some of the combats because they did things in the right order to find out where there was other things that were a problem. It was kind of bloodthirsty that our dwarf kept wanting to see what would happen if the brownies went in the room with the animated axes. I like it, though, because it's building towards something that is going to be less of a negotiation. But I kind of like that it's for first and second level. It is just, here is a fight at first level and everything else is role playing. Here is a fight at second level and everything else is investigating. I kind of like that.
And I think we did end about to fight something, but decided yes. We'd been playing long enough that we would save that the next time. We finally ran into something that wasn't going to go quietly.
After evicting brownies for the rest of the session. I've been getting more used to the shard interface. I haven't been running into a lot of things that are vastly different between 5e and Tales of the Valiant, because that was part of this as well. But then again, we're only second level at this point, so there's not a ton of that comes up. We had a little bit with like ritual spells and how they work the same way, except you can't cast them not as rituals in Tales of the Valiant. The other thing I need to get used to is awarding luck when we're not having combats, because we've had a couple sessions where we haven't had heavy combats, so people aren't missing attack rolls or saves. It does tell you, yeah, you should be awarding these for other things, but I got to get used to that momentum of doing that, because it is kind of like autopilot for people to figure out when they get luck during combat, at least.
With combat, it's easy. You get luck if you fail an attack roll or you fail a save. But if you're engaging with the environment and the NPCs and there is no combat and you're just doing skill checks, the failures for those don't automatically get a luck point, which means when you really, really wanted to succeed, you can't use them to add to the roll or re-roll because you don't have enough luck.
They do give you some guidelines on awarding luck outside of failing rolls in combat. And they revolve around meeting certain story goals, like you have accomplished this thing that you need to do before you, until you move on to the next section. Or when you put yourself in a disadvantageous situation for a reason. For example, if you were to surrender because they're going to let some other prisoner go, that would be a reason to hand out luck, not because you decide to throw a pie in the face of a necromancer because you think it would be funny. That sort of thing.
I mean, that would be funny.
It would, depending on the necromancer.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
While many computer RPGs allow you to play an entire party of characters, many of the earlier games didn't frame one of those characters as a single protagonist. Later CRPGs, like Baldur's Gate, started with a single character that you created and then included the ability to recruit other characters to flesh out the party, and sometimes they had quirks that might leave them to leave the party or trigger them to have conversations with other characters. Today we have so many CRPGs with companion characters, and what they offer beyond additional bodies in the party often includes subquests, the chance to learn more about the main plot, or even romantic entanglements. D&D has had henchmen, hirelings, and followers for a long time, but what does it take to incorporate the CRPG companion mindset into D&D, and do you want to? So, what are some of the CRPGs that we have played that have companion characters?
Okay, let me begin the list. All of the Dragon Ages. This includes Dragon Age Origins, Dragon Age 2, Dragon Age Inquisition, and yes, Dragon Age the Veilguard. All of the Mass Effects. This includes Mass Effect Andromeda, Baldur's Gate 3. I kind of skipped the first two. I was more into Icewind Dale back then, and there were some issues trying to get into Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 later. Neverwinter Nights, Divinity Original Sin 2. I also played Divinity Original Sin 1, but you only have like a couple of companions, and they're not as important as the ones in 2. And that game is of note because it was made by the same people that made Baldur's Gate 3. Pathfinder Kingmaker in Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous, and even Horizon Zero Dawn and Horizon Forbidden West give you some friends that you have to help with some story stuff, even if they don't go with you on your missions regularly around the world. But these are all games that you have people that are kind of part of your support network that are regularly part of the ongoing story of the game.
I would throw in Pillars of Eternity. That's another good one that is very much based on that same style of Baldur's Gate sort of adventuring and was actually done by a lot of the people that did the original Baldur's Gate game.
Yeah, I haven't played that one.
It's really good. I like it. I still haven't finished it because it's huge, but it's very much like the Infinity Engine kind of isometric viewing down on things type of thing. The other one that I wanted to bring up that has companion characters would be the Knights of the Old Republic games for the Star Wars franchise, which I will say, even though, you know, that's in space, it's space fantasy, so that totally counts.
Sometimes Star Wars is more fantasy than science fiction.
Yes, definitely. What do you think are the most common traits for CRPG companions to have in a game today?
The specific traits of the characters themselves are going to vary wildly, because the whole idea is that you are being given an ensemble of characters that are part of the story you're playing through the game. But as a whole, they're going to be interesting characters with hooks to the wider world to help deepen and broaden the story of the game. They're usually going to be from different factions, groups, or different parts of the world, which helps bring in that aspect of the world to broaden it for you, the player of the game. The best ones are all going to have their own individual reasons for being involved, which will sometimes cause conflicts and synergies, but they're always going to be interesting. The ones that are done the best.
So what would you say is compelling about interacting with these companions and with those traits?
In the best games, as I said before, it's they help flesh out the world. They give your character a reason to interact with different aspects of the world, different factions in the game, and it lets you build relationships with these characters. It's through conversations and side quests. You get to know who they are and build bonds with them. It really helps deepen the game. Like I said, I played Icewind Dale back in the heyday when Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 were popular, and I loved it. But in the Icewind Dale games, while you had a party of six characters, that was a party of characters you made. Yeah. They had no connection to the game.
You don't recruit anybody.
These are just the characters you've made in this party to go out and deal with the world at large. They were good games, mm-hmm. but they didn't necessarily have the companion characters that kind of help bind you to the game in a mm-hmm. way that like Icewind Dale doesn't, or games, other games don't. It makes you care about the world because you're becoming friends
mm-hmm.
with these characters. Another aspect that all of the good games have, romance. People joke that like Mass Effect is a science fiction dating sim. It's wrong, but it's not that wrong. Because the romances, especially in the really well-written games, are so engaging and good. There are a reason people will play the Dragon Age and Mass Effect games multiple times so they can try different romances.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could be like me and still end up romancing Alistair every single time you play Dragon Age Origins. My Mass Effect replay, when they released the remastered editions, I had to force myself to not romance Garrus. Because in my headcanon, that is the person FemShep is in love with. So, you know, but the romances are so, when they're done well, they're so engaging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I mentioned, the whole ensemble cast thing, it is a very interesting way of emulating the ensemble cast of a good show or movie while still allowing it to be a single player game. It lets you build connections and feel community
mm-hmm.
in a story when it's a single player game and you don't have to play a multiplayer game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it actually touches on another thing that I think is really good about the companion characters, especially in some of these franchises that have a lot of deep lore, because when you have a companion character from a different culture in that setting, you learn more about that directly from that character. It's not just something that you go somewhere and see a red wizard. You might have, thinking about the original Baldur's Gate, you might have somebody that is a red wizard of Thay in your party for a while. And you also might find out that if you try and recruit the Witch of Rashomon that you can recruit and you have a red wizard in your party, you will not be recruiting her into your party.
I think really in a computer role-playing game, what companions give you is a more intimate way to delve into the world building of the game setting.
Mm-hmm.
In Divinity Original Sin 2, each of the companions you pick up has different ties to the world you are going to be traveling through, which makes those storylines have a different personal touch. It's the same with Baldur's Gate 3. There are NPCs, adversaries you deal with that are personally tied to different companions you get. Of course, the brilliance of Baldur's Gate 3 is you don't, people can play it any way they want. Baldur's Gate 3 is, I think it's going to go down as one of the best games of all time because of how amazingly in-depth it is in how you can play the game
mm-hmm.
and how everyone is almost going to have a slightly different version of the game.
Yeah.
I'll say I've played it through twice. I've tried to romance Astarion both times and done it poorly. So ended up with Will in one game and Lazelle in the other. So there's a lot of variation there.
I don't want to go off too much on romance and gaming, but I have also noticed that over the years, the romances and how they advance or fail to advance and potentially fall apart has evolved a lot, because even in your early romances, there were sort of predictable things that would happen. like, oh, you talked to this other person and I don't like you talking to that person. Therefore, you know, this isn't happening anymore. And now you have a lot more nuance to the interactions that you have and what it actually means for you to care about this person and do things for them. So it has just kind of gotten deeper over the years with that.
I think it's important to note too, and I think this is something we talked about in a previous episode where we referenced Baldur's Gate 3. It is important to remember there is an entire team of people working on a computer role-playing game, and that includes an entire team of writers.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have just one person deciding how every character you are going to interact with acts. I mean, you usually have somebody, some project manager who's making sure everything stays in line with each other, you know, that nobody's doing something with the storyline that's going to completely contradict something else. But there's an entire team of people working on these things to make these games as in-depth as possible.
And we are going to go into that a little bit later about how you may want to capture the spirit of this, but not try to do exactly what a computer role-playing game does. What's funny is I was going to ask you about our companions in the Heroes of Hovel's Way, but I also realize there are people that we may not be able to talk about yet that qualify as companions because they haven't shown up in the actual play yet. So you had the first companion of any of us. So what has it been like having your little buddy?
I mean, nominally speaking, Monty, if you are not listening to Heroes of Hovel's Way, why not? But in Heroes of Hovel's Way, I play Odie, who is a Starlight Druid. Monty is her raccoon animal companion. There's no mechanical thing there that says she should have an animal companion, but we decided very early on that she could talk to animals, and she has this raccoon that she is besties with that follows her around and helps out as he can, and he kind of thinks Aramon, Jared's character, is pretty cool. But what Monty did is he helped provide some texture and flavor to Odie's background and helped kind of establish that she's a little unique. She's not, like, not every druid has the ability to just randomly talk with animals.
Yeah.
That's something special that Odie has.
You have some abilities that are, like, more natural and less strictly trained.
Yeah. And while we don't want to talk too much about the companion that will be coming into play, what I will say about them is that they specifically offer insight into deeper parts of the game's lore that we're discovering as the game progresses.
Yes. Which is very much like a lot of companion characters in a CRPG.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I wouldn't quite call them companions because we don't just get to decide we're using them whenever we want to. But the way Chris has them set up, we have stats for Emma and Robin, and we usually run them in combat because there's only two of us. And in a way, they are in the campaign more than other characters would be. So those are almost like additional companion characters as well, which has been interesting, and it actually gives me a romance option.
I think generally speaking, the way Chris has been handling it is he roleplays them all,
mm-hmm.
depending upon what's needed in the scene, with occasional suggestions from us, because I'll sometimes suggest what Monty would be doing.
Yeah.
But then in actual combat, Chris has us determine what they're doing, which is kind of almost exactly what would happen in a computer role-playing game.
Exactly. Do you think there's things that companions provide in CRPGs that may be addressed in other ways in your tabletop game that maybe you don't need companion characters to do?
Generally speaking, the role that companion characters play in a computer role-playing game are going to be filled by the other players at the table.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned earlier, a lot of the idea that companion characters give you is the ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up stuff for any Dragon Age game or any Mass Effect game or any of Baldur's Gate 3, what you will find is fan art of the companion characters together.
Yeah.
It's that ensemble cast. in a normal TTRPG, your ensemble cast are the other PCs.
Yeah.
Those are the ones creating the flavor and the dynamics of the characters in the story. So you don't necessarily need companion characters beyond the PCs at the table.
Yeah, and it's even more illustrative of that point when you see that they've been having the voice actors for Baldur's Gate 3 do a lot of actual plays with their characters. So they are actually functioning less like these are the companions to a main character and more like this is an adventuring party and everyone is playing their character.
Yeah, I highly recommend looking some of those up because one, those voice actors are absolutely fantastic and watching them play their characters at a table with each other is just like, oh, this is the DLC we never got.
We've already established that you don't necessarily need companions to flesh out your group because you have other players, but why might you want to include companion style characters in your tabletop game?
The GM likes to play too. Basically, when it comes down to it, having a regular NPC attached to the group of characters gives the GM more opportunities to roleplay and interact on a personal level rather than the overview level that you usually get with a GM playing everyone that's there. Having a character that's intimately associated with the group can also help encourage roleplaying in ways that it is harder to do when the GM is just the omniscient weather sitting outside of the party's campground. You know, it's like having an NPC right there in the mix of things. You can ask questions, start conversations, have scenes start happening that get the other characters involved, where like if it's, you know, just the party of players there and they're camping for the night and the GM kind of wants them to role play, it can be really hard to get them to do that without getting kind of ham-fisted. I mean, you can do it, you know, like, oh, so what are some of the stories you tell around the campfire tonight?
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, like you can get it started, but it's not always as organic as having a character in the scene that you can use to kind of start things up.
And I would say specifically this companion character idea that we were talking about is different than just saying, well, yes, the DM runs NPCs. But in this case, because you have that character in the party for a while and they are just naturally with the party, it doesn't feel like you just had an NPC wander up to camp and say, hey, didn't you want to go to that dungeon around the corner there? It's somebody that's actually been with the party going, oh my gosh, we almost forgot. We need to do this.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit more organic when it's somebody that has been with the group over time.
What are some current options for followers or additional NPC characters attached to the party in 5e and 5e adjacent games? And what are the pros and cons of those options?
So like the very basic thing is, 5th edition has been pretty good about having stat blocks that kind of look like certain classes at certain challenge ratings. So in other words, if you want a swashbuckler, you can find a swashbuckler at a certain CR and it has abilities that look reasonably well for a swashbuckler NPC. And it works well enough to say this character is with you. And if one of you wants to run it or the DM wants to run it, you have those stats. The downside to that is that sometimes those stats are within a certain CR range and there's not a version of them at other challenge ratings. So that CR might be great for your companion when they are third level, but by the time they're seventh level, that stat block is probably not going to be as helpful to wander around with them.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily want to have a fully statted out character class, you know, character with a class type of thing, because that gets a little overwhelming.
On the other side of the scale, MCDM had retainers in several of their abilities, like Kingdoms and Warfare. Those characters have a set number of hit points multiplied by the level of the person that they are that retainer is attached to. They have a signature ability and they have other abilities, like they get one at third level, one at fifth level, one at seventh level. You know, so they have abilities that they get as the character they are associated with levels up. The downside I would say to those is they are very flat. They have a very, very, very specific flavor of one specific thing that a certain class might do. And it may not feel as organic when they only have a few things that they can kind of spam over and over again. They're fairly easy to run. They just aren't that robust. You know, I say this because this is how I statted up some of our recurring NPCs in our game. Now, granted, they're not taking these NPCs out every single adventure. This was mainly for one big adventure where people were going to be running their character and an NPC that's associated with them. So it was okay that they're a little bit easier to run. They're a little bit thinner. But if they were going to have any of these characters adventuring with them on a regular basis, I really think the retainers are a little thin for that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that MCDM did, which I think is a little bit more robust, is their companion creatures, which we also had hanging out with us for a while, because that was our null child, who was a little void dragon. Those work a little bit better to me because they have a bunch of different things they can spend. They build up ferocity every round and they can spend ferocity to pull off certain tricks. The only thing about those is that measuring that ferocity is you're constantly having an extra resource that is going up and down that someone is having to manage on top of their own resources for their character.
I think it worked a little better with the null child versus the retainer setups. He seemed more dynamic. Also, I mean, maybe it was because he was a baby dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And the disconnect was that the other characters felt like they should have been fuller characters.
Yeah, I think that is another thing. The companion characters that they have done, they are meant to be creatures. This is a seasoned barbarian fighter. This is meant to be, oh, you found a hellhound puppy and now you're raising it. You know, it's supposed to represent that kind of thing, which is also another potential downside, because if you want your companion characters to be somebody providing extra information or side quests, they're not quite as good for that because they're kind of pets. So that doesn't work quite as well. The other option, which is what Chris is kind of using a modified version of, is the Tasha's Cauldron of Everything sidekicks, which are basically giving them a character class, but it strips them down to like a caster, a skilled character, or a primary fighter. So they have more class abilities that you can give them. You can make certain decisions at certain levels, but they are not nearly as robust as a full player character class. They don't have subclasses. They do things that a class would do, but they don't do extra things that a class would do.
Yeah.
Yeah, the main thing I would say is a downside for the Tasha's version is that it's not as in-depth as running a full player character, but it has some of those elements to it. Because like if you're a caster, you have spell slots, you know, you're going to have to deal with that sort of thing. You may have different, like, do I use this tactic or this tactic if you're a fighter? So it's not quite as complex as a full class, but there is a little bit of that decision making that you do have to deal with those. Then the last one that I can think of, which I'm sure there's plenty more that I haven't seen, but in Empire of the Ghouls, there's a specific chapter where you have NPC characters with you, and the way you run them is on, like, I think it's initiative count 20, they get to do a thing. You decide what the NPCs are doing, and that is their action. They don't have normal stats or anything else, but they can do things like protecting the PCs, and if they protect the PCs, then you say, well, there were four of them, now one of them's injured, and they can't, you know, you can't take care of them until the end of the fight. And then you have fewer options because one of them is injured now. So now you have one less thing that you can decide at that initiative count. The downside to this is basically that it is in one chapter in one adventure, and you have to kind of extrapolate what they did there to make your own version of it. I actually did this with the first game that I was running for my daughter and her group. It works fairly well as long as nobody is expecting that character to do anything other than a very simple thing on their initiative count.
What kind of mechanics already exist to track relationships with NPCs in 5e, and can those be adapted to work more like companions in computer role-playing games?
So both the 2014 and 2024 DMG have an optional loyalty score that you can give to NPCs that the PCs interact with. The score goes from 0 to 20, and on a 10 or higher, they are considered a trusted ally. So as long as you have them at a 10 or higher, they are going to be happy and they're going to do dangerous things on your behalf as long as you don't treat them badly. There are situations where it spells out, like if you specifically leave them in danger when you would have protected somebody else, you subtract loyalty from them. If you do something that is like desperately against their beliefs, you roll like 1d4 and subtract that much loyalty from them. And if they get to zero, they are no longer loyal. They will not work for you anymore. They will not associate with you anymore. And that is a thing that happens with certain companions in certain games. Like, you can get to the point to where some companions are just fed up with how you're playing the game and they walk away. And that does kind of model that same situation there. One thing that I would say is you could set target numbers. Like, the first time you manage to get loyalty all the way up to 20, this character gets a certain new ability that they didn't normally get. Or that's when you trigger them saying, hey, did I ever tell you about my uncle that I've been desperately looking for the last 10 years?
Side quests.
Yes. I think the main thing I would say about that is don't flood the game with those. Once per NPC that you have that is a regular with the party, I would not do that more than once per tier of play. So in other words, like, you know, from the time they're first to fourth level, don't keep throwing these out there. Maybe say have one thing that an NPC throws out there as like a really quick side quest and that's it. There's also a few places where they do have some things to track relationships if you want to get into the romance side of things, which is a whole other thing that we need to be safe about. But on top of that, A Life Well Lived actually has a progress thing that you can do in downtime to track how well you are advancing a relationship. And I think it's kind of neat. And it isn't just a matter of I rolled really well, because you still have to explain what did you do during downtime that you are building this bond. It also isn't a thing where you necessarily will, you can technically get negatives and start dropping that number, but for the most part, you're going to just be pacing how long it takes to either romance the character or get into a deeper friendship or something like that.
What are some of the biggest challenges to adding companions into a campaign?
So it is going to be harder for the DM to predict how difficult an encounter is going to be depending on how many NPCs you have traveling with the party. Like, for example, in my daughter's group, when they had their companions, one was a druid and one was an apprentice wizard. So I just had them, their only options were to throw cantrips on their initiative count. But it can get a lot more complicated than that, figuring out, like, is that extra cantrip killing off extra monsters that I should have put a few extra ones in this encounter in the first place to make this more challenging? More characters mean more actions, which can slow things down. So even if you have a handle on how much better the NPCs are making the party at tackling challenges, you may not know how much longer it's going to take you to resolve those challenges. You do need to figure out whether the player character or the DM is going to be running them. And DMs are often very, very swamped with what they are doing.
I would say do not add companion characters into a campaign if you're not going to use them for role-playing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We're talking a lot here about some of the mechanical issues you need to be aware of with companion characters in a D&D game or a D&D style game. But if you're just doing it to have extra characters on the field of a fight, it's not really a good reason to do that. I mean, like, it is a totally legitimate thing if you want to run a campaign where the players are playing more than one character. That's a viable thing, but generally speaking, those games are not going to be heavily into the role-playing side of things. They're going to be in the tactical combat side of things. Think about why you might want to add companions to the game. The other thing I would say is be very careful of the dreaded GMPC. You can poke around the internet, talk to your friends who've been playing for years, and you will find horror stories of the GMPC that ends up stealing the spotlight from the players because that character is so awesome that it overshadows all of the PCs at the table. I think even Chris has talked about this on podcast before. It can be totally cool to have a NPC that's associated with the party that's acting as a companion to the characters that you as the GM get to use as your conduit for role-playing with the group. But you never want them to be the ones in the spotlight. You want to allow, you know, them to help the other characters not take over things. You know, and honestly, one of the things I would recommend with companion characters is make them non-combatants. You know, don't make them so fragile that they'll die if they get caught in a fireball. especially if they're at the level where they're going to be dealing with fireballs. But having them be support characters or, you know, more in the background might be a little easier for you as far as statting the game, running the game, all that. Because, yeah, the more characters that can do actions in combat, the harder it's going to be for you as the GM.
Yeah, and I was going to say that's not entirely unlike what I have done in our Midgar game, because except for that last session where we intentionally had everybody with a special other person with them, these characters don't adventure with the party. They just kind of hang out at the house in between adventures so they can interact with them during downtime. But I mean, a lot of that thought process is that most of them are adventurers too, that go off and do their own things while the party is doing things. It just happens that you have a connection to these other adventurers.
Should the companions be NPCs created by the GM, or should they be created by the players?
To invoke the
immortal words.
Yeah, the longstanding warlock patron of internet RPG discourse, Sean P. Kelly. It depends.
Thinking about this, I think some of it is going to come down to where is this character coming from? In the case of some of these side characters in the Midgard game, they are characters you created that started interacting with our group and ended up sticking around. In at least one case, the character idea was created by the player and ended up coming into play later. That's specifically Kazina's twin sister, Anezik.
Mm-hmm.
She was somebody from my backstory that we ended up rescuing, and now she's around as a side character. Now, I didn't build her. You know, I didn't create any of the mechanics for her. It was more, here is the idea of a character that is important to Kazina, and she is missing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a story hook that ended up turning into an NPC.
Yeah, and basically what I knew from what you had made of her, other than that she was your twin sister, is that she was in on all of these scams that your father would have all of you doing. So I knew she had to have some sort of criminal talent, but in order to make her a little bit more distinctive, she is technically a bard and not a rogue. So, and that's partly because she learned more of the confidence game side of things that, from your father, than just the picking the pockets and opening the locks and everything.
She got all the charisma.
Yeah, she's the one that should be making all your downtime checks.
Poor Kazina.
But yeah, I think that I really think, though, that becomes an organic thing. For example, like in our Heroes of Havel's Way, you mostly made Monty, but our other characters that are kind of in that companion space are characters that Chris came up with, but some of them also developed because we gave them part of their backstory. So
yeah,
it's kind of a give and take there.
Yeah, and you know, like I mentioned, sometimes it's a perfectly valid way to play to have the players have other characters that they can run. In that case, if it's a they created the character, they're running the character in combat, it's essentially their side character, that's fine that it's all the player's stuff. But, you know, it's also if the GM is trying to help flesh out the world through NPCs that the players are going to be getting close to, then they should probably be created and you know, handled by the GM.
Mm-hmm. There was another thing that I was really silly and didn't even think to bring up, but we didn't talk about the difference between how different games do companion characters, because early on you had your companions and they filled out your party and that was it. But now you mentioned Mass Effect, you don't have all of your companion characters with you at one point in time.
Part of the game is going out and collecting your companions.
And I think that might not be a bad idea if you do want to adopt this idea of companion style play, to say, okay, which one of you or which two of you are going to have companions with you this time, as opposed to everyone always has everybody that's a companion with them all the time.
Yeah. I mean, even Baldur's Gate 3, you pick up some of them fairly quickly, but Will is a little further into the game and you can actually miss Karlach.
Oh, yeah.
Which, don't do that because she's amazing.
But honestly, there are, I mean, just speaking of Baldur's Gate 3, there are characters I wanted to recruit that I hardly take out with me, but I want them in camp so that I can talk to them. because they have some awesome things to say about, you know, situations that just happened. I just don't like using them in the party that often.
I think that's actually a good point to bring up, because this is one of the issues that happens with computer role-playing games that have companion characters. You develop your favorites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you develop the ones you enjoy taking out the most and kind of have your ideal party to go with you. I love everybody, so I try and mix and match and, you know, bring different people out, especially because I love the banter in these games, which is not something you're going to be able to do in a tabletop RPG.
That is definitely interplayer banter.
Yeah, you cannot recreate the banter between the companions because you are one person. You know, it's not going to work. You don't want to overload your campaign with companion characters if the players are only going to gravitate towards one or two. Don't do the whole, every player has a companion to their character, unless you want to use it for a special occasion like Jared did for our big fight in the city,
mm-hmm.
in the burning temple district. So what's our final checklist for determining if you should have companion characters, and what do you need to do to prepare for them?
So first off, I would say make sure everybody in the group is interested, because it's going to affect the whole campaign. And when I say that, I mean somebody might want to do it, but even if other people don't want to do it, everybody should be on board with it.
I don't think you need to get, like, you don't have to have every player buy into having an NPC that is associated with another player's character. But if they're going to be traveling with the whole group.
Yeah, that's more what I'm thinking. If somebody doesn't want to have a companion at all, you don't necessarily need to make sure everybody says they want to have a companion, but you do need to make sure everybody in the party is okay with this player is going to have another character with them that might draw some extra spotlight time. Are you good with that?
Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked in character, Marin would have told you no, we should not have the Void Dragon with us.
I believe he vocalized that several times, even after it started to fall on you.
Many times.
I think it's also important to know what everyone wants from having companions in the campaign. Do you want to emulate that thing where you unlock special abilities that they didn't have to begin with? Do you want them to provide side quests? Do you want there to be romance, which also is a whole other part of the process that you have to deal with later on? Yeah, we already touched on this, but you need to manage expectations about how often you want to spotlight those companions. Because again, it's giving a player more spotlight time, even if it's not just giving their character more spotlight time.
I mean, you can do stuff to make sure that companion role plays with the other characters in the group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you shouldn't just have them only interact with the PC they're associated with.
Yeah.
You know, have them interact with other people in the group so you can, like, if that character, that NPC is going to be involved in a lot of stuff.
Harold is far more interesting now that he is kind of friends with all of you and not just Ivy. Make sure you know who's going to be controlling the companion and in what situations. Like we were talking about, I think most of the time, if you find a solution for the companion stats that are simple, you should probably have the players running that and not put that burden on the DM. Not just because it's another thing for the DM to run, but also you're asking the DM to, you know, don't think about which monster you should go poke, because you already know that this one needs to be dealt with. Ignore that yourself. Me, don't do that, you know?
I would also say it is very important to make it clear that it is the GM running that NPC in non-combat situations, you know, in role-playing choices in situations, the GM is the one making the decisions.
Yes. We talked about this before. If you're going to include romance and strong emotional content, is that okay with the group? And establishing your guy, what does romance mean? What is everybody okay with being seen? What do you want to have happen off screen? How do you want to signal that? Romance is a whole other topic in and of itself, but we have to put this in here because this is part of, you know, having a companion character that you really have to think about.
Yeah.
We talked about this before, but mechanics that you want to use for the companions, you know, what option is going to work best for you? What do you need to track for the companions? And by that, I mean, are you going to use loyalty scores? Are you going to use something like in A Life Well Lived, where you're keeping track of how well the relationship is progressing. How mechanical do you want tracking beyond just their combat stats to be?
You don't have to do any mechanical tracking.
You don't. No, not at all.
You can totally just go with vibes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is this NPC thinking of these PCs right now?
Oh, yeah. I am almost certain that Chris does not have loyalty numbers set up for all of our NPCs that we interact with. And there's nothing wrong with that. The main reason I mentioned loyalty and all that is some people may really want that feeling from RPGs where they can look and say, look, I got their loyalty up to 18 now. And that's fine. Just know what it's going to entail.
And I think in a game where you may be wanting to emulate the PCs having to win over certain factions or groups, that can be extremely viable with interacting with those NPCs.
How often are the companions going to be active? Because you can do a situation where you have the whole stable of them that just is at a home base and they don't come out except for very special adventures. How many are going to be active at one time? We talked about this too. Like, if you have six players and they all have companions, are you going to let all six of them have their companions out and adventuring at one time? Or are you going to say, no, I choose sanity?
Choose sanity. Please choose sanity. Maybe do it once for a big boss fight, but
I strongly advocate DMs pushing themselves to do very special scenes. I do not advocate DMs pushing themselves every single session to create novelty every single time you play.
Yeah.
Can they die?
If you kill a Nezik, I'm coming for you.
Which is a good point right there. Are they okay with that companion dying? Is it something? It's very easy to just say your companion is out cold. They can't help until after the fight. You can easily do that and not worry about ever killing a companion. Where I would also throw this in there is animal companions. That is,
I was just thinking, if Chris kills Monty, we're going to lose so many listeners. So many listeners.
And what's funny is in the time between when we started talking about this topic and when I've been reading, there is actually a condition in the 2024 DMG that you can swap out for someone being dead. That is just them being in stasis until you can revive them.
Ah.
I kind of like that. And I kind of think I would float that by people if they were going to have companion characters in a game. And can they leave the party, and what would cause that? And is that going to be something the DM decides? Is that going to be something the player decides? Or is it going to be something you leave up to random mechanical chance?
That's some drama right there.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've kind of said our say on companion.
It's a big topic.
Yeah, it's a bigger topic than I expected.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related in D&D that we want to pass along to you, our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. First, though, our Eldritch Invocation. We have a Patreon now. So if you'd like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we would love it if you decide to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material like the map Chris made for the campaign setting, and also a lot of other stuff related to Heroes of Hovel Way. That is patreon.com/thac0wa. If it is not already clear, I am playing and loving Dragon Age the Veilguard. No, it's not D&D, and it's not directly going to enhance your tabletop RPG experience, but it is fantasy and dragons. There's a lot of discourse about the game out there, and a lot of it is in very bad faith. There are people saying the game is bad, the game is too woke, and so on, without ever having played the game. It's really annoying. It's to the point where I have muted so many gaming social media that I used to just casually follow in the background, because it has become some people's personality trait to jump into any conversation about this game and tell you how bad your fun is for enjoying the game. Now look, every Dragon Age game has been different from the others, and this one leans into the action RPG rather than the tactical game that you could play in the first one. The art style is much more stylized and not realistic like some previous games attempted. And there can be arguments made that the dialogue choices aren't varied enough. And those are all legitimate reasons for someone to be a bit disappointed in the game or to decide it's not for them. But for everything else, the game is visually stunning. Combat is a ton of fun. The companion characters are interesting and engaging. And it is absolutely the world of Thedas giving you answers to questions that people have been asking since the first game. I am really in love. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's best game ever. Because honestly, I think Baldur's Gate 3 is probably going to be considered a classic for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's not a game of saying it's better than anything else. Not a game of saying it's better than any previous Dragon Age game. It's saying this game is a ton of fun. It is currently available on PC, PS5, Xbox. I'm playing on PS5 because my PC is outdated and I can't afford to replace it. So if you want to chat about it, come find me on our Discord.
I would throw in there too. You said it doesn't directly make your tabletop gaming better, but it kind of does. Anytime you pick up story elements from another fantasy story, that broadens your perspective on what you can throw into your games, what you can add to your character. One of the things I love about Dragon Age is the whole dwarves and that their religion is ancestor worship, because that was not something I thought of until Dragon Age. And after I heard it, it was like, that makes so much sense for dwarves.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wouldn't say it's not contributing to your tabletop gaming. Although if you want to say it's not contributing because you're not at your tabletop because you're playing.
I have not skipped on a gaming session because of Dragon Age yet. Yet.
For my contribution, if you're one of the people that appreciated Legends and Lattes and Bookshops and Bone Dust, the Wraithmarked Creative Illustrated Deluxe Edition of Bookshops and Bone Dust is available now for pre-order. And when you pre-order, if you want to, you can pick up the version that they did for Legends and Lattes. If you don't know anything about the stories, it's about adventurers in a D&D-like fantasy world that decide to pull all their gold together and put it to good use trying to start up a business so they can retire. And all of the complications that ensue in a fantasy world where an adventurer tries to retire. I have not read Bookshops and Bone Dust yet, but I loved Legends and Lattes. It was like, it's like one of my favorite books. It is great. I love it. You should read it. Both books cost $100 each. So I know that that's kind of steep, but they are very pretty books. They have the gold gilded edges on all the pages. They have full color art end papers. They have this cloth wrapped case to keep them in pristine shape. They have the ribbon bookmarks in them. They have black and white illustrations of all of the, basically for every chapter, there's like an illustration of a character or a scene. So there is a lot that goes into this illustrated edition. And I know it's $100, but it's a book. It will love you forever.
I currently have Legends and Lattes on my Libby waiting list because I asked Josh from Gnome Stew for some recommendations, and that was one he gave me.
Yeah, I really like that book. It's a lot of fun. We are happily part of the Polygamerus Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamerus podcast like
The Heroes of Hovel's Way. The Heroes of Hovel's Way is an epic fantasy story about two young heroes, Odie and Aramon. These heroes have the potential to deal with a dire threat from an ancient time that is poised to return to the world. A Titan Destroyer, Valhel Morris, the Mountain Strangler, stirs. The fate of the Barony of Castakin may be in their hands. We play the game to find out and invite you to join us on this journey.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.